The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of means of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 4 of this 5-day sesshin here at Hidden Valley Zen Center in January 2015. And we will continue sharing the story of Morinaga Soko Roshi's early training years. You recall that Morinaga Soko was a Rinzai master, abbot of Daishu In at the time of his death in approximately 1997. And he was one of the rare Zen masters in Japan at that era who actually taught foreigners. A couple others actually did as well. Well, there were really three others. There was a Zen, Kokusai Zendo, that was one. There was Daishu In under Morinaga Soko Roshi, Sogenji under Harada Shoro Roshi, and Bukkokuji under Tangen, another Harada, Tangen Roshi. And otherwise, the temples in Japan, the Zen temples in Japan, essentially only took Japanese, of which there were not so many. Japan being in a very exciting economic time, and people were less interested in spiritual things than they were immediately post-war when Morinaga Soko began his Zen training under Goto Zuigan Roshi, who was at the time abbot of Daishu In. You've heard that what prompted Morinaga to enter training was the fact that it was the latter years of the war, 1944, when he was in high school, and because he was not a science student, the science students were spared, but anybody who was in literature, philosophy, other majors in high school was drafted because they were running out of young men. And drafting meant being drafted to learn how to pilot a fighter plane, and with just one intent, and that was to, when the time was right, to go out on a mission and crash your plane into an enemy ship. In other words, it was a one-way ticket. And this suddenly brought these young men up to the face of death. Just before he was conscripted, both his parents died, his father almost immediately after his mother. And so then he was drafted into the military and trained as a pilot. Unfortunately for all of us, he never went to fly his mission. Came back and found that in the reorganization that was established by the American occupation, that the family land had disappeared, that the assets that would have supported him, or helped support him at least, from insurance of his parents were frozen because the bank assets were frozen, and so suddenly he was quite a ship without a rudder and wandered around for a while. He went back to high school, finished high school, and then that was about it. He couldn't figure out what to do with his life, and he had had no real training. He just spent long hours arguing with his fellow students about philosophy. And after the war, they did the same thing. And then he graduated, and then what? And after wandering around a bit, he decided he would have to try to enter a Zen temple. And so he tried a number of them, and finally Goto Zuigan Roshi, who was retired at the time and spending his retirement in Daishu In, which is still a sub-temple of headquarters temple of the Rinzai sect Ryo Anji, And Suigan Roshi demanded of him that in order to be able to live and train under him, he had to place his trust in the Roshi. And you heard that Morinaga Roshi, Morinaga someday to become Roshi, initially lied about that and had many, many moments where he was inwardly annoyed, angry at what he was being asked to do, how he was being asked to do it, and so forth. And one of the first lessons that he was taught was that, as Goto Suigan Roshi put it, in people and in things, there is no rubbish. In people and in things, there is no trash. And that points to a fundamental understanding in Buddhism that no matter what our behavior, the core being of each person is perfect, whole, and complete. So then comes the big question, why, if we're perfect, whole, and complete, do we do things like going to the Charlie Hebdo offices and ritually murder various journalists? Why are we willing to blow ourselves up in a public area in order to destroy people? Why was Hitler allowed to run amok in Europe, killing millions of people based on his own arbitrary judgments about them? If we are so perfect, whole, and complete, how can these things happen? How can these things happen? This is worth taking in and pondering deeply. And of course, we have to do it in the realm beyond words, because just as Morinaga discovered in his late night discussions with his fellow high school students, you can't solve anything with words. You can't get at the core issue with words. You can talk about it, you can talk around it, but you cannot truly solve it. And this is particularly the case with this question of why is there suffering in the world if we are so perfect, whole, and complete, as the Buddha and countless human beings following him discovered, realized, and how we ourselves can open to that as well. In people and in things, there is no rubbish. So we have, at this point, gone along with Morinaga Soko, who's spent a year training with his teacher, Goto Suigan. And at that point, Goto Suigan Roshi says, all right, now it's time for you to join a monastery, because there are many things that you can learn in a group of people that you cannot learn alone. And as a young novice monk, you've got to train with other monks to really do appropriate training. So he has gone to Daitokuji, another one of the headquarter temples of the Rinzai sect. There are 14 of those in Japan, and two of Soto sect. Both Soto and Rinzai are about all that remains of the Mahayana Zen lineages in Japan. So he went to Daitokuji and proceeded to experience what is called niwazume in Japanese, literally waiting in the garden. The practice is to go to the business entrance of a temple that you want to train at, the Genkan it's called, the little foyer, the vestibule of that temple. It's often right off the kitchen. And put your head down on the step and stay that way for hours, days, weeks, to express your determination, to prove to the people in the monastery that you have what it takes to persevere in the face of adversity. Because anyone who's done very much Zen practice knows intimately that things will come up for us. We will begin to face all of our dragons, or at least we will begin to have all our dragons come up one after another. Whether we face them or not will make a big difference in our deepening of practice and our freedom from them. But because, unlike in many other religions where that really isn't called for, and it really doesn't have an opportunity to come up, except perhaps in certain traditional monasteries in Europe. If you've ever seen the movie Into the Great Silence, it's about a very ancient monastery in France in the mountains, and the monks who commit to a lifetime, not only a lifetime, but a lifetime of solitary existence in the midst of their fellow monks there. And one of the things that they have in that ancient monastery is a prison where they put monks who have had enough of the training there and tried to run away. When they're caught, they're brought back and put in the prison. Interesting way of going about it. We don't put Zen practitioners in prison. We have certain rules, we have certain regulations, we have certain expectations of people who are entering into training, and they are in order to help us deepen our training, become free of where we have created bonds for ourselves, chains for ourselves, restrictions. So that even if we were to be thrown into Buchenwald, as Jacques Le Serran was, even in the midst of that extreme constriction, starving, threat of death imminent in every single moment of the day and night, we can still, like Jacques, become truly, deeply, and honestly free. And not only free, but filled with joy in each moment, as he was. And he wasn't crazy. He was enlightened. So, back to Morinaga Soko. He went to the Genkan that Daitokuji, put his head down on the step, and there he sat. And it was winter. Actually, not sat, knelt, really. Because it's a step. It's not a chair. It's not a comfortable position to keep, particularly not for hours and days. And for 3 days, he remained there, testing his own courage, testing his own commitment to practice against all kinds of abuse. First, when he asked for permission, eventually somebody did come, already a test of his patience. They didn't come immediately. He had to keep calling out. And then when the person did come, took his papers, went presumably to show them to the abbot, and came back and said, "You're too skinny. You don't look like you've got what it takes physically to manage this place, so get out. Go somewhere else." But he persisted. He stayed there, which, if you want to train in a monastery in Japan, you've got to do. And then, sometime later, another monk came out and said, "He's still here. We told you to get out of here. Now get out of here." And he still stayed. And the next time somebody came, they came with a keisaku and wailed away with him, beat him out of the Genkan. And then when he saw that person had disappeared again, he crept back in and resumed his cramped posture on the steps. This went on for 3 days and nights. For some people, it goes on longer than that. So let's take up at this point what he's been going through. It says, my niwazume lasted 3 days. By the end, my face was congested with blood. All my teeth felt loose, my eyes felt as though they were popping out of their sockets, and my hips felt as if they'd been wrenched out of joint. I'd come to Daitokuji on the 1st of March, and it was bitterly cold that year. All I had on my feet were sodden straw sandals. The cold had risen from my toes to my thighs. My legs had become completely frozen and numb. I think it was an act of real courage to go on and on in this state, pulling myself back from the brink of exhaustion and despair to carry through with my vow to practice Zen. By the way, we are sharing his story. It's written in a chapter in a book that was put together by my Dharma brother, Kenneth Kraft, called Zen Tradition and Transition. And each chapter is written by a different either Zen master or a professor who is an expert on the subject of Zen training. The cold had risen from my toes to my thighs, and my legs had become completely frozen and numb. I think it was an act of real courage to go on and on in this state, pulling myself back from the brink of exhaustion and despair to carry through with my vow to practice Zen. And that is what it is for. It is to test that vow. Because Zen training is not easy. There are going to be moments of joy. And if we persist, there's going to be considerably more than that in our later years. But as we make our way through our conditioning, through our habit patterns of greed, anger, and delusion, through our assumptions about ourselves, it's not going to be fun. These are things we would prefer not to look at. But in order to truly be free, we have to. When I was in school, I would sometimes pick a quarrel with someone to show how brave I was. However, fighting with others is not courage. It's behaving like a small dog with a loud bark. Real courage is enduring and holding firm in the face of one's own faint-heartedness. I would not have learned the truth of this had I not been forced to question myself over and over again. Many thoughts passed through my mind during those 3 days at the monastery entrance. The interminable hours made me think also of all those who come to practice in a monastery. They're from different backgrounds, with different talents, experiences, and concerns. There would be little likelihood for any effective training in the monastery if each person were to insist on having things run the way that suited him. And this is a very important point. Periodically, we'll run into someone who decides that they're not willing to do the prostrations, or they're not willing to do the chanting, or they bridle at the schedule. This is the reason why, if one gets faint of heart and decides to arbitrarily leave a sesshin, there's no second chance. You don't get to come back to sesshin again. Not that one and not a future one. There was one exception to this when I was head of Zendo at Rochester Zen Center. At one sesshin, there was a young man who vanished. He simply disappeared. The second morning, he wasn't there. He had fled. 4 years later, he applied to another sesshin. And I had a sixth sense about him. Ordinarily, he would not have been accepted because he had left. But the abbot had forgotten that he had left, and I took the risk and I accepted him. And at the end of the second night, I found him in a crumpled, sobbing heap outside my room. The fear, the anxiety, whatever it was that drove him out of the sesshin the first time, was there again. But this time, his determination was so great. He told me that he had had his wife drive him to the center. He left his wallet at home. He left his keys at home. He had no money. And he did this on purpose so that if he lost heart again, if the fear came up to a point again where he wanted to leave, he wouldn't be able to. He lived quite a ways out of town. I brought him in. We talked a bit. And he went back into the zendo for the evening sitting, and he stayed through the entire sesshin. And I don't think anyone was more joyful than he as the sesshin ended, because he had bested his dragon. And from then on, he was able to come to sesshin without a problem. There was another Zen student in Rochester who always used to come to 4 days of a sesshin. Apparently, it was on the fourth day that his dragons decided to come out and play. And so he would leave candidly before they got too difficult to deal with. And one day he decided to risk it and sign up for the whole 7 days. And he knew well, because he'd been coming to sesshin for years, that if he fled, that would be the end of any possibility of coming to sesshin again. And late in the fourth day, he was literally, quite literally, shaking on his mat. But he hung in there, and he was ecstatic by the time he left sesshin. Not because it was over, but because he had faced those dragons, and they hadn't taken him out. What we don't allow ourselves to see is going to cripple us. It's going to operate behind the scenes, pulling our strings, causing our reactivity, even if we don't deal with it, and particularly because we don't deal with it. So when that stuff comes up, we find ourselves angry, frustrated, ashamed, fearful. Fear is one of the things that comes up for most people at some point in sesshin, some point in the practice. If we don't turn and allow ourselves to experience the felt sense of these things, they're going to drive us. Our temptation in our usual daily life is to shove it under the carpet, turn away from it, pretend it doesn't exist. But if our Zen practice is to lead to awakening, we can't do that. We have to face the music. And the interesting thing is that when we learn how to do that, it's amazing the spaciousness and freedom that can open up right in the midst of fear or anger or whatever emotion has come up for us. Suddenly we find a place of freedom. Freedom from having to act out of whatever it is that has come up. This is tremendous. This is tremendous. But if we're not willing to face our stuff, if we're not willing to see what comes up, and this is not about dredging things up, as we do our practice, naturally bring ourselves deeper and deeper, experiencing that out breath further and further out, it requires a letting go. And a letting go can be of the constraints that we put on ourselves to keep things shoved under the carpet so that things can come up for us willy-nilly. And when they do, there is such an incredible opportunity to become free of them. Countless people have discovered this to their great joy, because once you've learned how to do it, it doesn't matter where you are or what it is that's come up, most likely, you can do it again. Now here I need to say something about severe trauma. Severe trauma is something, if that's in your history, you want to work with an expert therapist on. It's a little bit beyond where Zen normally goes. But our ordinarily difficult times, our moments of anger, irritation, even mild trauma, can usually be dealt with in a very healing way through our Zazen. To continue, many thoughts passed through my mind during those 3 days at the monastery entrance. The interminable hours made me think of all those who came to practice in a monastery. They are from different backgrounds with different talents, experiences, and concerns. There would be little likelihood for any effective training in the monastery if each person was to insist on having things run the way that suited him. In the West, there's a saying, new wine must be put in new bottles. I realized that if I intended to pour the new wisdom of enlightenment into my own vessel, I must enter the monastery completely emptied, humble, and compliant. I had to discard all my previous social standing, knowledge, and opinions. This cannot be emphasized enough. If we are insisting on our own opinions about things, if we are insisting on writing the rules, there's no room for enlightenment. It's impossible to experience. During the evening of the third day, the monk on duty came out and said, "As you're still here, despite having been scolded and beaten, you show some measure of resolve to practice, so you may come in. However, you're not yet formally admitted, so you'd better keep your wits about you." Allowed in at long last, I was taken to a room open to full view with but a single wall. The sliding doors on the other three sides were open. I put my bunko down, that's his satchel with his robe in it. When they say robe, I mean he is dressed in his robes, but it's his kesa, his formal robe that's put on over the regular robe that he's talking about keeping there. I put my bunko down and sat in Zazen facing the wall, which is all I could see. As anybody might be looking in from the other three sides, I could not relax for a moment. I was given three simple meals a day, and at night I was provided with sleeping mat and allowed to sleep. I spent 5 days in that open room. So he had 8 days of trial, testing his determination, testing his courage, testing his willingness to put up with whatever he needed to put up with in order to come to awakening. He proved himself. I spent 5 days in that open room, so for a total of 8 days, I kept asking myself why I was there and what I was trying to do. Time and time again, I had to remind myself of the vow I had made to practice, rally my flagging resolve, and repeat that vow. Thus, I became a monk at Daitokuji Monastery. After 15 years of hard Zen training, I received Inka from my teacher. I was able to persevere through those long years of practice thanks to what I learned at the very onset, through experience, not theory. At Daishuin, I had been shown the meaning of trust. At the entrance of Daitokuji, I had learned the meaning of the courage which has its roots in faith and which remains undaunted whatever resistance is encountered. Zen Master Hakuin identified three essentials of Zen practice, and these apply in many other realms as well. A great root of faith, a great ball of doubt, and a fierce tenacity of purpose. In my early years at the Rochester Zen Center, Kapler Roshi often quoted Hakuin on this and said, there are three essentials to Zen practice. Without these three essentials, you really can't make it. Great faith, great doubt, and great determination. And my heart would always sink because, as far as I could tell, I had no faith whatsoever. And I certainly didn't have any doubt. What was doubt all about anyway? I only learned much later what that was about. All I could say about myself was that I was stubborn. And thank goodness I was, because it was certainly worth it. By great doubt is meant perplexity. This perplexity that comes up around the statements I made at the beginning of the Teisho here. Why? If we're all complete, perfect, is there so much suffering in the world? Why are there wars? Why? If we're whole, perfect, and complete just the way we are, wouldn't we live in harmony with all beings? So how come we can't? Another way that perplexity comes forth for some people is a sense that there's something that you knew intimately long ago and had lost contact with or lost track of, and that it is vital to return to that connection again. And indeed you can through the Zazen. And the fastest way that I know of doing it is through the extended out-breath, the Sosokan practice that we teach here. To continue with Morinaga Sokoroshi, a great root of faith, a great ball of doubt, and a fierce tenacity of purpose. The great root of faith means trusting one's teacher and the tradition they represent. It also means believing in the limitless potentiality that lies within oneself. The limitless potentiality that lies within each one of us. It's a matter of uncovering it, that's all. We have what it takes. Though at first glance it would appear that a great ball of doubt is the exact opposite of a great root of faith, it means to be aware at all times of one's own lack of insight and to harbor within oneself a deep trust of I, meaning me, myself, my self-image, who I think I am. Fierce tenacity of purpose means to have the real courage to continue the practice, whatever the obstacles. Without these three essentials, nothing can be accomplished. I realized the truth of Hakuin's words not by listening to sermons or reading books, but by practical experience. Had I not learned these lessons at Daishuin in the entrance of Daitokuji, I doubt that a half-hearted young man in his 20s would have found the strength to persevere in a Zen monastery. However much society may change, I'm convinced that Hakuin's three essentials constitute the cornerstone of all achievement. People today have lost the feeling of trust in their education and in their daily lives. Especially among younger people, it has become acceptable to criticize one's surroundings, to shirk one's responsibilities, and to change one's mind continually. Adults commonly pander to the young. School teachers think it is their job to make their classes as appealing as possible to their pupils, and parents are encouraged to dote on their children and raise them with the least possible constraint. I knew a family once. We lived near them in Thailand when we were living in Chiang Mai, and then after we returned to the States after our tour of duty in Thailand, they had already returned to the States. The father of the family was a university professor, and we eventually, I went to visit them in Illinois, where he was teaching at that time. At the time when they were living in Thailand, they had two young sons who were stair steps between my two sons. And the boys were ferocious to be around. Their parents stated that they were trying to raise their children so that they would have no inhibitions. And no inhibitions is what they had, that's for sure. My kids, when we were invited over to Thanksgiving dinner at their house, the kids said, we don't really want to go. Those kids, they fight us, they grab our toys, they're not nice, they don't share. And so we took along some books in the car and said, it gets too much for you guys, just go on out to the car and read your books. By the time we saw them again several years later in Illinois, they had adopted a little girl. She was 3 years old, and they were using the same techniques with the daughter. And the boys by that time were 6 and 8 years old, and absolute terrors. Their father had to take us to the university commons in order to have any kind of visit with us, because the kids would jump into our laps and wave their hands in front of our faces, demanding attention when we were trying to talk to their parents. Those kids are in their late 40s, early 50s at this point, and I can only imagine the grief that they have encountered once they get out in the regular world away from family. And I hope, like Morinaga Soko Roshi, that they learned that their behavior really had to change if they were to be happy and if they were to fit into society. Yet how understanding is the society these children will eventually enter? Far from being a world full of fellow feeling and mutual consideration, it's a world where everyone is concerned solely with himself, unfortunately. People not only ignore the misfortune of others, they may secretly be pleased by their neighbor's straitened circumstances. And as a result, when children pampered by easygoing parents and educated by amiable teachers step into the world as it is, they become confused and despondent. How could it be otherwise, since their upbringing and education have taught them neither self-reliance nor resourcefulness? And this is not about being brutal with our children. Not at all. This is about teaching the children, giving them opportunities to develop their own self-reliance, to develop the creativity to survive in the world, to develop that innate compassion and wisdom that can be further uncovered through our Zen practice. Why are you reading this account? If just out of curiosity, you will only have learned about someone who lives in a different world from your own. Rather than discuss Satori, or the heart of Zen, I presume to relate my own experiences as a young monk because I hope readers will find something of practical use, something relevant to their daily lives. I am not especially concerned that Buddhism flourishes or that the Zen school prospers. What I consider most important is that each individual lives a fully fulfilled and truly contented life, at peace even in the face of death. That is the primary aim of Zen, no matter how foreign its external form may at some times appear. Great is the matter of birth and death. Life slips quickly by. Waste not a moment. Wake up, wake up. This is often what is written on the han in Japanese temples. And in Rochester, it's recited as well. because it is the truth. We have this short life of however many years. Depending on our karma, we don't know when it will end. It could be suddenly snuffed out. Or we could live a long, fulfilling life. But the crux of the matter is, the moment of our death, how will it be? As we are suddenly realizing that everything, everything has to be let go of. And it's not a matter of choice. It will be let go of regardless of whether we want to or not. And it's also said many times by people who have experienced it that when a person gets close to death, truly close to death, their life will flash before their eyes and they'll see much more clearly how they've lived it. The colored glasses that allowed them to see things in a rosy glow earlier in life are suddenly clear. But at that point, it's too late. How will it be when the light of our eyes is falling? Will we be like the crab with its 7 arms and 8 legs struggling to get out of the boiling water? Or will we be like the enlightened masters, simply not drawing the next breath in, at peace with the going, at ease with life and death? I thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the 4 vows.